Good afternoon. Welcome to the 3 o'clock docket of the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel this afternoon is to my right, Justice Sue Walker. To my left, Justice Bob McCoy. I'm Leanne Dofino. We had a 1:30 docket, and we have two cases set for oral submission on the 3 o'clock docket. I understand that now everybody is here and that y'all are ready to go. So if you'll call the first case, please.
The court will now call Concern Owners of Bissell Hill Estate Space 1 LLC versus Ryan Road Management LLC et al. May it please the court, Mr. Stanley Broom will argue for the appellant. Mr. Bill Wood will argue for the appellee.
You go by Stan?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Stan Broom, and I represent the appellant in this matter. The appellant is an LLC. It's an association that was formed to assert interest on behalf of its members. The name of the association is Concerned Owners of Thistle Hill Estates, Phase 1. Some of those members were able to come today. The reason that Concerned Owners of Thistle Hill Estates, Phase 1, or as we call it in our brief, COTHIP 1, was formed was because every member that's part of this particular LLC owns a residential house in this particular community. Every member who owns a house in this residential community is regulated by a set of declarations. These declarations were filed by the original builder, called the declarant in the particular document. And this particular dedicatory instrument gives that declarant the ability to do all sorts of things in regulating their residential property. What the court might need to understand is the fact that the reason that my clients are so upset and form this association is because that particular declarant or builder is really just one person. And she gets to decide almost everything that happens that relates to these people's homes. This person gets to decide how much of the assessment's going to be every year, what the Architectural Control Committee might agree to allow to be built right next door to them, whether grass gets cut, whether flowers get put in the common areas. All of these things are not decided, as in my community or many other communities in this area, by a homeowners association that's elected amongst the owners of the residential community. Instead, it's all been decided by one person. And this has been going on since February of 2000 when the original dedicatory instrument was formed. Now, the issue for appeal that's before the court today is very narrow, and it's just one of standing. Can these people bring this complaint to enforce the Texas Property Code through an association, or do they have to each individually sue? Courts have liberally allowed associations to bring forth litigation that would benefit their members on a broad area of things, and you don't have to do any more except than just watch the nightly news or read your newspaper this morning to get examples of this. The National Rifle Association often challenges legislation or seeks to enforce legislation related to the Second Amendment. The Federal Aviation Administration regularly litigates on behalf of its pilots, and you could just go on and on and on. The reason that the law has recognized that these types of entities should have standing is because what an association can do combined is often much greater than what an individual person could do. And I think in my brief, I put the example of a pilot. Let's say that the FAA caused some new regulation to be enforced on pilots that they all had to retire when they were 40 years old. An individual pilot might not be able to afford litigation to challenge that type of a regulation, but their association certainly has an interest in doing that, has the resources to do that, has the ability to do that. That was the concept that COTHIP 1 had when they decided to join and form this association. They knew that litigation would be costly. They knew that they were going up against a well-funded developer. They knew that in order to do it, they would have to join forces. So they formed this association. The trial court said they didn't have standing and they had to each come at it individually. Courts have recognized a three-prong test to decide whether an association has standing. And I would urge you to find that we showed that we met each one of those prongs. The first one and the second one simply aren't in dispute. The trial court agreed with us. The first one is individual members would otherwise have standing. We filed an affidavit that explained to the court that in order to be a member of this particular LLC, you had to have residential property. If you sold your house, you were immediately not a member, and that meets the prong of individual members would otherwise have standing. So in other words, what I'm saying is each one of the members of this particular association, if they wanted to come into court individually, would have standing to do it. Why? Because they own a house, and it's governed by this particular dedicatory instrument. The second prong is this. Interests of the association are germane to the organization's purpose. The affidavit we filed informed the court that the purpose of the organization consists solely to enforce the rights of the homeowner. So it's certainly the particular association's purpose is germane to this particular litigation. The third one is what the trial court complained about, and that is claims asserted and relief requested do not require the participation of individual members in the lawsuit. So what were we asking the court to do? We were asking the court to enforce some legislation that the legislature passed specifically to curb abuses of builders of residential property. And if you look at Texas Property Code 209.00591A and C, those two articles are specifically what we allege in our petition that we would like the court to enforce. The name of the act was the Texas Residential Property Owners Protection Act. My worthy opponent on the other side has pointed out in his brief that I gave no legislative history when I just conclusory in his words say that this was passed to curb abuses of developers. One need only read the title and only read the words in the statute to understand why this was passed. This was passed for exactly this circumstance where you have a builder who won't release control even after the builder has sold lots or a long period of time has passed. So this is what it says. It says that after 75% of the lots in a community that are controlled by a dedicatory instrument are sold, or after 10 years have passed, the declarant or the developer must allow some of the board members on that association to be elected within the community. And it bars anything that's in a dedicatory instrument that would run afoul of that provision. In plain talk, it says this. If you want to go build a residential community, you can do that. But after you sell all your lots, or a certain percentage of the lots, and after a certain percentage of time has gone by, you gotta let these folks self-govern. You have to allow them to serve on the board so they can make their own decisions. So this particular entity, this association, was formed in order to enforce the Texas Property Code. Now, the order that the judge rendered in this particular case, holding that we did not have standing, was odd in that he looked for the third prong to the declaration itself that we were challenging. And he pointed to a provision, 11.7 of the declaration, that you wouldn't ever know to look at unless you were familiar with this case and actually looked at what had been filed in the property records. But 11.7 says that the owners can enforce the declaration. And the judge said, the trial court judge said, wait a minute, the declarations say that only individuals can enforce the declarations, therefore, the association can't bring that lawsuit on its own behalf. Two problems with that. One is, that's not what it says. It just gives the right to any homeowner to enforce any particular restriction that's contained in the declaration. It doesn't limit it only to particular individuals. Secondly, and more importantly, is this. We're not seeking to enforce the declaration. In fact, we say the declaration should be determined to be null and void because it's in direct violation of the Texas Property Code that I just referred to. So here's what the trial court judge did. We came in and said, Judge, declare these declarations to be null and void. And the judge said, to determine if you have standing, I'm going to look at the declarations themselves. That circular reasoning would completely gut the purpose of the legislation. What was the purpose of the legislation? The purpose of the legislation was to curb abuses by home builders. If home builders can simply write in their declarations some particular magic words that bar or require only individuals to come and seek to have the property code abided by, then guess what? Most individual homeowners are not going to take on big developers. It's just not going to happen. That's not what the legislation that, was intended, and the trial court just simply got his reasoning wrong. Now, the other prong of his order just said that the third prong is not met, and he didn't elaborate. So as a reminder, the third prong is claims asserted and relief requested did not require the participation of individual members in the lawsuit. So you have to ask the question, what did we seek in our lawsuit? We sought a declaration that the property code be enforced. We sought a finding that the declarant had a fiduciary duty over the funds that it had collected all of these years. That's a question of law that is certainly within the third prong. It can be determined without looking at what the individual members paid. Now, what my able counsel will hook on is the fact that as alternative relief, we did ask for actual damages in the lawsuit. But we did it in this way. We said, do the accounting, and to the extent that there are funds that have been used that weren't used to benefit the community, return it to the association. That was the intent of our asking for actual damages. The other side hooks on this and says, wait a minute, you're asking for actual damages, which ipso facto must mean that we have to look at every individual and how much they paid. And I say, no, that's not what you have to do. You just have to go look at the books that the declarant controls and decide, the court will have to decide, if those funds were used to benefit the community. If not, they get returned to the association. You don't have to look to see if Mary Jo paid $50 or if Bob Jones paid $100 or anything like that. What you have to look at is whether or not it was used to benefit the association. The other side also argues that
benefit the association?
I'm sorry.
Benefit the association?
Yes, whether the funds have been used in the past by the builder to benefit the association. If they weren't used to benefit the association, they should be returned to the association.
Why would the developer benefit an association that was created to get rid of the developer? Wouldn't it be benefit the homeowners or benefit the community, but not?
I see the disconnect. If I can try to address the court's question, if I misunderstood, I'll be quiet and see if it can be restated. But what we were asking for is that there's an association, quote unquote, that exists already that is one person. To the extent that the court finds during the course of this lawsuit that those funds that have been collected by that person have not been used to benefit the community, that person, the builder, the declarant, needs to return those funds to the association. Now, the reason that's important to the standing argument is that we can see claims asserted and relief requested have to be the type that don't require individual members to be part of the lawsuit. And what I'm trying to point out is that the lawsuit does not seek a return of specific dollars back to particular people who paid them. In fact, the people who paid those, say, 5 years ago, they might not even live in the community. We're just asking that that money be returned to the association. Even if that portion of our relief kicks us out of the third prong, what the trial court should have done is said, you have standing to bring the declaratory action to enforce the Texas property code, but you can't get damages. Had he said that, we could have amended and we could have gone forward with our lawsuit. Instead, he just threw us out. And we don't believe that that is the correct result, even if we sought an element of damages that might not be recoverable without bringing the individuals in.
Practical matter, in your mind, what is the advantage for this individual to remain in charge?
One more time, Your Honor, I'm having just trouble here.
Practical matter.
Yes.
Not having to do with an issue in this case. Why, in your mind, does this individual want to remain in charge and have these duties and responsibilities without benefit?
I have no idea. The very first phone call I made in this case, I asked the question, hey, most builders want out once they have made all their profits from selling their lots. Is that something that might be on the table? And I've never gotten a satisfactory answer.
We'll
I could speculate.
We'll ask opposing counsel in a second, then we'll give him a heads up.
Thank you so much, Your Honors.
take 15 seconds to say it's a pleasure for me to appear here. I've been doing it for about 42 years, and I tried to remember the number of times I've appeared in this court, but I'm not able to, but thank you for the opportunity. The facts that opposing counsel related to the court are, they have no more proof in this court than they did in the trial court. There were no facts proved in the trial court. I just have to take up a few things counsel said. He said the trial court agreed that the first and second prongs of this test were complied with. That's not accurate. The trial court's order speaks for itself. It made reference to a specific finding about the third prong not being complied with, but it simply granted the plea to the jurisdiction.
I have a question about that. In the plea to the jurisdiction, don't we take all the facts pleaded as true?
Well, I had a question about that too as I became more familiar with this law. I think you do, with an exception, and that is where proof is required. And I can demonstrate for you that proof was required in this instance because we challenged the jurisdictional facts in our plea to the jurisdiction. This court, as well as the Supreme Court, have authored some opinions that declare that under such circumstances proof is required. Essentially what happened is there was a hearing, and I'm telling you now, proof was required, and I'll get to that. There was no proof. There is no reporter's record. The clerk's record contains the pleadings of the parties and the order of the court, and when a plea to the jurisdiction challenges the pleadings as the one we filed did, the first thing that has to happen under the law is that there must be a determination about whether the court has jurisdiction to hear the case. If you can't do that from the pleadings, and though actually I say that under our laws, this court could have done it from the pleadings alone because counsel's pleadings negate jurisdiction of the court. Essentially, there's an allegation that a LLC was suing an individual and two entities for breach of fiduciary duty, for damages, and I'm sorry, it's not a claim for alternative damages. It is for actual damages. It is not alternative in his pleadings. So, in the Supreme Court case of Texas Department of Wildlife, if a plea to the jurisdiction challenges the existence of jurisdictional facts, relevant evidence must be considered when necessary. We get some guidance from the Supreme Court in the Bland versus Blue. It says there are situations in which a plaintiff is required to prove facts that might be characterized as primarily jurisdictional. The court said in that opinion, for example, when a defendant asserts that a plaintiff organization does not have standing to assert claims on behalf of its members, which is what we asserted here, an evidentiary inquiry into the nature and purpose of the organization sufficient to determine standing does not involve a significant inquiry into the substance of the claims. Rather, a determination of standing is a prerequisite to the plaintiff's presentation of substantive evidence. So I think that's what we have here. The court went on to say, in sum, a court that's deciding to plead to the jurisdiction may consider evidence beyond the pleadings and must do so when it's necessary to resolve the jurisdictional issues. Now, regarding whether there was evidence or not, pleadings are not evidence. There's no argument about that. The only other type of evidence was an affidavit that was filed, but that was never presented to the trial court. No ruling was sought to gain admissibility. No ruling was made admitting or denying the affidavit. Had there been, the same objections that we've made in our brief, which are conclusory, legal conclusion, that those objections are good, that affidavit doesn't prove anything, and it was not offered as proof, and it's not proof in this record. And two types of standing, general and associational.
Well, I have another question procedurally. Procedurally, if the pleadings don't state standing or subject matter jurisdiction in a plea, in when attacked by a plea to the jurisdiction, then if the plaintiff can replead, we have to remand to permit the plaintiff to replead.
I think so. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. So I was just going to say, then would that be the appropriate relief here?
No, I don't think so. I agree with the court, but that is true where the pleadings allege facts but do not allege facts that divest the court of jurisdiction. Here, the pleading is that the association was formed by members, formed by its members, for the purpose they alleged. I say there's no proof of that, but it's an association. There's no connection between the association and the parties that are sued. There's no allegation, there's no proof that this association paid any money, that it was assigned any claims of the individuals. In fact, there is a discounting of the fact that it has any standing in this lawsuit. So had there been a, I think that could have been the case, and it, if that were the case based on these pleadings, this court could remand it and ask for a more specific pleading. But because the specific absence of, because we challenged the jurisdictional facts in our motion, they were had an obligation to produce evidence. We had a hearing. The court called the case. No evidence was produced. There's not a reporter's record. There's no evidence in this record showing that they demonstrated anything. But if you look just at the pleadings and look at two cases from this court, the Texas Municipal League versus Burns, it's in our brief on a panel in which Justice Daffino served. Standing pertains, this is general standing first, pertains to a person's justiciable interest in the suit. This association, this LLC, has no justiciable interest.
I thought that associational standing was decided almost exclusively by the three factors set forth in the U.S. Supreme Court Hunt case. Are you saying that there are other factors superimposed? I thought that the Hunt case was based on the case and controversy finding, you know, required by the Constitution, and that those are the three factors that are required.
This court is right. That's associational standing. But there's another analysis, and that is general standing. And I'm saying that they don't get there on general standing because they don't have a dog in the fight. If we go to associational standing, and I say in the brief, and we say here that there's no evidence to support the first two prongs because they didn't put on any evidence. But as to the third prong, this court's decisions established as a matter of law that they don't get there. The third prong is whether an association has standing to invoke the court's powers on behalf of its members, and it depends on the nature of the relief sought. If this court said, like in this case, if the association seeks damages on behalf of its members, or must otherwise prove the members' individual circumstances to obtain relief, participation of the individual is required, and the third prong is not satisfied. In another case, the Big Rock case, and I only have a Westlaw site, but Justice McCoy served on this panel in an opinion that was authored by Judge Walker. And among the findings and decisions in that case, first, a plea to the jurisdiction is a proper vehicle to challenge standing. That's what we did. The plaintiff bears the burden on alleging facts that affirmatively show the trial court has subject matter jurisdiction. We say they didn't do that, and they didn't bring evidence. Usually, the court said in this opinion, an association's claim for damages on behalf of its members is barred by want of the association standing to sue, because such suits, typically require each individual member to participate in litigation to establish its own damage. The individual member concerned, and as to both the fact and the extent of the injury, require individualized proof. In the Big Rock case, the court said, here an association seeks relief and damages, like this case, for alleged injuries to its members. They alleged no monetary injury to itself, like this case, nor any assignment of the damages claims of its members. So there isn't any allegation or any evidence that there's been an assignment to this association of any claims for damages. Those two cases determine precedent as a matter of law to declare that there is no standing because the third prong has not been satisfied.
Does the record reflect what triggered this? Was there a protest over paying the money to this management company, or
no, Your Honor?
Was there an order issued that every house had to be pink, or what triggered this?
There aren't any allegations like that. The only thing in the record is the unsworn allegations, and then the affidavit that really doesn't get anywhere that we say wouldn't be admissible anyway. If you're asking what triggered it, I think it's a fair assumption from the pleadings of the plaintiff below that there were dissatisfied persons in the subdivision that wanted more information and believed, as they say in their pleadings, that the money that they're paying is being misused. And I think that is an answer to your question about what triggered it. As far as what triggered it in terms of the procedural events in the lawsuit, there's just a pleading, a motion, a hearing, no evidence.
What are the obligations of the management company contractually?
What are the obligations?
Of the management company.
They're set by contract, the declarations that are attached to
it. What are the obligations of the management company? Contractually, what are the obligations of the management company?
You know, in summary, I'd say just generally to take care of the common areas of the subdivision.
No obligations? Just collect the money?
That obligation.
It says that in the contract, that the management company has obligation to maintain the common areas?
I think it does.
Well, I don't know because I'm not looking at the contract.
Okay. Well, I believe it does. I'm not absolutely certain.
Okay.
I teed the ball up for you and gave you the club, and you haven't swung at the ball. So why would an individual want to remain in this position of these responsibilities and obligations for no reason?
Well, the reason I didn't swing at it, Your Honor, is because that pitch isn't in this game. But to answer your question, I'd say that because there were difficult and volatile accusations made against my client by a few people, and my client, the individual, wanted to insist that that she have her day in court.
Okay.
Thank you again.
Thank you, Bill. Stan?
Just very quickly, we talked about remedy. I want the court to recognize the number of times that we tried to come back into court and do whatever the judge needed us to do to satisfy an unspoken claim that we didn't fulfill the third prong. We filed a motion for leave of court almost immediately. I believe it might have been the next day. We keep hearing today that there was no evidence. That's not true. And we keep hearing that they filed this plea to the jurisdiction attacking our facts. Their plea to the jurisdiction are these two sentences. In response to this, we filed an affidavit
by the manager of the LLC that set forth, this is what the purpose is of the LLC. This is why it was formed. This is what it does. This is the only way you can get to be a member of. And we presented that in our brief in opposition to their plea to the jurisdiction, and we had that hearing. At the conclusion of that hearing, hearing words back from the bench about various concerns that they had, we immediately filed a motion for leave to file additional evidence, and that motion just simply was never heard. Then we filed a motion for new trial, and I made all the arguments that I made right here, and that was met with nothing. I believe that there are
You agree that the organization has to show injury, not individual members of the organization who haven't assigned their injuries to the
Great question, group. And my answer is firmly no. There's no assignment needed, and here's why. It goes to the third prong. It says, the claims asserted and the relief requested do not require the participation of the individual members. All we're trying to do is get them to follow the law, and the association can do that. Associations do it all the time. For example, the trial court at the conclusion of this case could issue an order, and the order could say the declarant hereby has to follow the letter of the Texas Property Code on or before X date. They have to hold elections. During those elections, there has to be a certain percentage of the board pursuant to the property code, and on and on and on. That's all that's required. An individual member doesn't need to come show their damages. And more importantly, the association itself is not who shows their damage. The association is damaged because it consists of members who have a special interest. Just like any time the Sierra Club or the FAA brings a lawsuit, they have members who have an interest that's germane to this particular whatever issue happens to be in play. And so in our particular case, we have an interest. Our members have an interest in having the Texas Property Code followed. So far, this declarant has thumbed their nose at the Texas Property Code, and that's not in dispute. It's simply not in dispute that they're not following the Texas Property Code. This association, formed by this interested people, seeks a declaration from a trial court saying you got to do that. I don't know of any other way to do it unless this court sets the very troublesome precedent of saying individual homeowners have to come individually to do it, because you and I both know what will happen. It's not going to happen. My house, live in a beautiful neighborhood. I have a homeowners association, but if I get to run, if I happen to be the president of it, but if I was not allowed to run for that, would I take my time, effort, energy, money, and resources and go against the developer of a 500 home upper class community? Absolutely I wouldn't. I just wouldn't do it. I would punt. And that's what's going to happen to this statute if associations aren't allowed to be formed to have a common interest and to go forward with that common interest. Thank you very much.
Any questions? All right, thank you. We appreciate you coming in here to argue. We appreciate the help you've provided this court. Your case is submitted. You're released to go about your business if you want to. If you want to stay and listen to the next case, you are certainly welcome to do that.